Hello, it's good to talk to you. I want to spend today opening the consideration that we will give over the next several weeks to the First Amendment in its constitutional singularity and to the happier fate of the rights against government interference or structuring of our lives that it is both intended to and useful to protect. We are here treating a more favorable conjunction of ideas over the last 300 years and a different and, for our purposes, more effective constitutional structure created by the First Congress. But before we try to understand why the First Amendment may provide us with particularly useful resources, not only in this society but in others around the world, as we think about the rights of citizens in a networked world with a species-wide extraskeletal nervous system connecting everybody, the way in which we understand that circumstance, the comedy that is the First Amendment, is intrinsically related to the other side of, like, the pairing of tragedy and comedy in the iconography of the theater. It is crucial for us to understand what it is that the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment, for which we have just lived, ultimately represents. And for this purpose, we need to think again about the third dimension of all of our inquiries, the technical as well as the political and legal perspective from which we come at the propositions that the constitutional regime forces us, nil we, to confront. One aspect of the Fourth Amendment's difficulties in the 21st century is related, as I tried to show, to the alteration from search to surveillance to mass surveillance as the forms of government industry and industry near government in the collection of potential criminal evidence against persons. Results. The problem of mass surveillance, that is, of the extraordinarily comprehensive collection and the extraordinarily effective absence of forgetting about everything, whether in private hands or in government hands, ultimately redounds to the disadvantage of free people. Because part of their freedom, their autonomy, consists in the preservation of their secrecy and their anonymity, and both are difficult, if not impossible, when they are committed to technologies that spy on them and to the use of services provided to them, quote, free, close quote, by private intelligence services that wish for their own commercial purposes to collect everything. This meets the determination of government to attribute everything in an environment in which the challenge that results for citizens' autonomy is the unscrupulous and unending effort to acquire it all and to know what it means. Hence, the importance of technological alternatives for people to use, which don't depend upon surveillance for free services, and which therefore require government to behave not with some new and more profoundly complicated standard with respect to citizens and their lives, but with respect to the 18th century structure of I have it, I keep it, if you want it, get a warrant for it, and convince the magistrate that there is basis for what you're doing. to turn us back from society of mass surveillance by a privatized form of comprehensive secret policing to a system in which government has to justify its breaking of the seal around our lives through demonstration to magistrates of probable cause to believe things. Not an overwhelmingly difficult standard, ultimately resulting in a broad reasonableness culture which favors the police, none of which we might in detail absolutely want to leave unadjusted if we could make all the decisions on behalf of society, but which are nonetheless compromises well understood, however much they may be from moment to moment deplored, and which depend upon mechanisms which, if we determine to use technology so as to converge on the meaning of the ideas that animate our constitutional order, we can turn to our advantage. This, a culture of trying to preserve privacy through technology as well as politics and law, was robustly challenged in the conversation on the pad last week, not only by particular participants, but by the broad consensus of the conversation that this is somehow to ask the impossible. I want, just before we change the subject utterly to the world of the First Amendment, to explain my doubt about the depth of the resistance based on difficulty. There are, in the world of investment opportunities, few things more desirable than the opportunity to invest in addictive commodities. If you teach the history of the Western Hemisphere, or as in my case, the history of the English-speaking part of the Western Hemisphere from the late 15th century, when Europeans began to penetrate the screen and cause all sorts of havoc to erupt, through the period at the beginning of the 19th century in which, among other things, the first British Empire had been destroyed and a constitutional empire created in North America for the English-speaking North Americans to possess the continent, which they more or less then, more or less militarily did. If you teach that history, then the extraordinary importance of investment in the addictive commodities known as tobacco and sugar is front of mind throughout your attempt to understand the development of the societies that brought what they brought and took what they took from North America, constructing an extraordinarily powerful and ultimately self-destructive system of human slavery in the process. But that's because commodities that addict their users are good to invest in. Their markets are secure over the long term if they can be adequately oligopolized. The history of tobacco is the most valuable of all the histories that we can give here, but the histories of opium trades and cocaine distributions and salt monopolies by governments are equally important. When we consider the way in which surveillance capitalism was sold to capitalism, it's important to understand that a theory of quasi-addictive structure dominated the way that the investors were brought in by what came to be known in the econo-dwarf jargon of the early 21st century as network effects. Tobacco, too, benefits from network effects But it's important to recognize that in the adoption of the technologies of the new nervous system, which made its physiology, addiction is only an appropriate metaphor if you don't pay attention to the fact that addictions are life-limiting. Because, of course, one of the really important ways in which the network effects of surveillance capitalism were sold to capitalism was everybody will suck it up because they do indeed receive real benefits, because participation in the cross-connected, globe-girdling, superorganism's nervous system will, in fact, improve human life, which it does. Those of us who had something to do with the building of it may have had a different view of which benefits it would bring to the human race collectively. We may have less interest in the swipe to date or swipe to buy than every brain on earth can learn whatever it wants aspects of the possibilities of this nervous system. But nobody disputes its extraordinary benefits in helping people to get more out of their lives. Nobody disputes it, and certainly not those who, like me, spent time building it from the very beginning and have lived within it for half a century almost, and whose own technological aspirations it also embodies. We are hardly likely to speak against the benefit of a system of services in a species-wide interconnecting network when, after all, at least speaking for myself, the most important service is the ability to allow every brain to learn whatever it wants by delivering everything everywhere to everybody, regardless of the ability to pay or the whims of the government under which they live. But it isn't the value of the services which legitimately causes people to want to use them that is the problem. It's the cost of the services. The malstructuring of a market which over-centralizes services, thus giving the oligopolists an opportunity to control price, which they do at what is apparent to the user, zero, but what is unapparent to the user, everything in all, the kingship of space, the total sovereignty over the information of the way in which the people live, from the finest grain of the detail of individual lives swept up by the spy satellite called the smartphone in your pocket, to the biggest and most important emergent qualities of the human race, whatever at any given moment those may be, and however they may be exploitable by private and public power. A bad price to pay for having a calendar that you can see from wherever you are, and from having communications with your family and friends which allow you to share whatever you want to share, and etc., etc. So the question of the technologies we use is the question of the prices we want to pay for the benefits we want to have. A market, I suppose everybody will immediately conclude. And a market in which, like all other markets, society has efforts to make to prohibit the frauds and the distributions of poisonous counterfeit commodities and the conduct of unsafe or unfair business practices and all the other ways in which it is, after all, the case that markets are social structures created by people in which at least those of us who aspire to equality among people recognize the need for constant efforts at structuring wisely and operating fairly. It's in this context that it becomes feasible to ask, well, if we don't like the way all of this has turned out, if our politics, our law, and our constitutional rights seem to be on ice floes separating as the climate breaks them up, what could we do with our technology to assist us in filtering the environment around us for the benefits that we used to have and would like to preserve? And this is the reason why the restructuring of the market for services, as simple as whether your calendar is stored in the maw of a private intelligence service in California or on a tiny little object under your bed, is really important. Hence the idea that if we made it as easy for people to use services by plugging something in somewhere and letting it gather dust, as we make it to get services by acquiring them from privatized KGB, we would be serving a purpose which is constitutional in character, as well as small for us to achieve collectively with small effort or small investment or small social change. Like the protection of the right to vote, which ultimately can come down to rather simple structures to enact or to achieve on top of everything around us, hence the broad difference in the United States at the moment between one party seeking to take those steps and broaden the electorate for its electoral advantage, and the other party having to argue that it's really bad to use newfangled technology like the mail to gather ballots and to arrange for their being counted. We can derive great value in the environment of the failure of the Fourth Amendment from small changes in technological infrastructure of life, which carry with them large constitutional outcomes. It is certainly feasible to argue, as many did last week, that for one reason or another they don't want to do that or think other people they know won't want to do that, and at the end of the day, well, let's throw up our hands. As I say, it's a legitimate argument. I personally have spent a couple of decades of my life doing something else and believe in the rightness of what I did, including the effort to address the need for such technologies through things like the Freedom Box Project that apply free software stacks to the cheapest possible hardware, omnipresent throughout the world and capable of being purchased and run by individual human beings at very scant cost, and which every 12-year-old can intellectually master in order to achieve at least the possibility of the kinds of outcomes I'm talking about. Naturally, in an environment in which the learning that we are trying to do is primarily about politics and law, there is only so much space in all our collective communications and each of our individual heads for discussions that are purely technological in character. And if one were to divert the conversation we are presently having to purely technical matters in a way which gave the impression that technology is determinative or that law and politics have ceased to matter, then one would be doing the same disservice to the quality of the analysis that one would be doing by ignoring the technology altogether. Beginning in the first week in March, after you have turned in a first draft of a first essay, we will begin conducting some technological exercises designed not to produce an overarching view of how everything ought to be operated so as to maximize constitutional freedom for everybody, but so as to offer a few simple incremental ways in which you can begin yourself to use technologies which improve your privacy, that is, your autonomy, your secrecy, and your anonymity against the private intelligence services as well as the public intelligence services with which you come into contact every day on the net. And in the end, I will try, by the time the warm weather arrives, as improbable as that may now seem, and we are coming to the end of the journey of this year, as improbable as that may seem, I will try to have at least suggested a series of pillars of what it is, incrementally and, I hope, pretty much painlessly, to transition your life and to know how to transition other people's lives towards greatly safer computing and communication. This does not alter in any way the other portions of the analysis that we devote to the constitutional relations between citizens and states in the era of the net, unless it does. That is to say, you are yourself the test for what it is that we accomplish when we study this subject. Freedom begins by knowing that another future is possible. So let us then begin, with the time remaining to us in this week, the project of understanding what another future is possible might mean with respect to the First Amendment to the United States Constitution and the institutions around the world which it has inspired or enabled. I think it's fair to say that there is no area of American constitutional law in which clausification has achieved a greater degree of density in the counting of clauses per sentence, or a greater degree of intellectual fragmentation on the basis of the resulting dense clausification than in the area of the First Amendment. As usual, the 18th century bequeaths to the future an idea embodied in a sentence. And in the common law style of subsequent, by which we really mean 20th century, American constitutional law, in capital letters, the resulting idea and the sentence that embodies it are blown to smithereens and reassembled into what Tom Emerson rightly referred to as the system of free expression. There's value in this, as there was immense value in Emerson's categorization of the system of free expression. But there is value for us in particular trying to project the First Amendment fully into the 21st century to begin with the thing itself, that is, a sentence written in the first Congress at the end of the 18th century by legislators who perceived an idea. The idea is, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Even the use of a couple of semicolons doesn't change a sentence into a mess of clauses in a bag. And the style of the first Congress, like the style of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, is worthy of a committee. That is to say, this is carefully written material produced by professionals working in teams to achieve what they regard as clarity and operability in legal documents. A sentence it is. But this then requires of us that in order to understand it, we have backpedaled significantly from the world of high-density clausification that the great scholars of the First Amendment in the course of the later 20th century turned this object into. We need to begin, then, with the subject of the sentence. That is the First Amendment, which is Congress. Now, this, like the Fourth Amendment, will eventually be subjected to an incorporation method which will change everything. And in the case of the First Amendment, the application of its rights through the Due Process Clause of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment fundamentally modifies and adapts itself to the clausification idea. But oddly, even though, of course, it appears that the incorporation of the First Amendment and therefore the application of all its principles to the relationship between state government and the individual is quite an important step, just as it is with the Fourth Amendment, ironically, in the world in which we actually live in the 21st century, to think of the questions, of the issues posed to us by the networked society in the areas of free expression and the cultural liberty of people, Congress is in fact the subject of constitutional primary concern. It is the power in the government that really matters. Nonetheless, we are recouping an 18th century meaning by beginning with the recognition that the First Amendment, unlike other parts of the statutory Bill of Rights then used as amendments to the Constitution, the First Amendment speaks in specific terms of how and where it proposes to limit government. The limitation is on the Congress, which shall make no law. So here we have to begin by recognizing that the First Amendment speaks in a particularly clear way towards the legal proposition about the federal empire being created by the 1787 Constitution in a specific fashion. The empire is prohibited from addressing certain subjects because Congress is prohibited from legislating. We should therefore keep in mind that the primary meaning of the First Amendment is that federal lawmaking shall be prevented from occurring, and federal power shall therefore be prevented from being granted further scope with respect to certain elements of the national life. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The prohibition of federal imperial level lawmaking is neither an abdication of an element of government to the states, nor a reservation of those rights in the hands of the people only. It is both. It is both, as we shall see when we come to parts 9 and 14, it is both with respect to the fact that when Congress is prevented from legislating on some subjects, Some subjects will therefore be subjects of state legislation, and some will be subjects of no law. That is to say, a place in which the people acknowledge no duty to respect government's opinions or the weight of its hand. The sentence, which is the First Amendment, then begins by ruling out areas of lawmaking in the federal imperial government now being created and operated in replacement of the Articles of Confederation and in replacement of the previous centralized federalism of the first British Empire. It is apparent that Congress is to get out of certain elements of the despotism business and to stay there. The areas that have been ruled out from legislative activity are areas in which it is not merely feasible to imagine, but historically inevitably to expect that imperial layers of government will act, if they can act at all, to reduce the powers of local governments and the people, and thus bring on cataclysm. Here, English history and the history of the religious differences in Europe in the 16th century are the primary inspiring historical structures that the people of British North America and the legislators of the First Congress understand. But they understand them not only in respect of theoretical propositions about their own existence that they can find in the history of England or in the history of the Netherlands. It is not merely what happens when a Catholic king attempts to rule a Protestant country, or what happens when a Catholic king in Spain attempts to rule a Protestant country in the Netherlands. It is what will happen in the United States to disunite them at every level if Congress is able to do what imperial governments in the historical experience of British North Americans have done. Doing, that is, what legislation actually achieves, rather than form, is the subject of the First Amendment. Laws are described not in terms of what they say they are, but in terms of what they do, in the sort of pre-realistic structure of federalist political and constitutional thinking. American legal realism wasn't invented only at the end of the 19th century. And so, the First Amendment, having identified the subject, which is Congress, and the effective structure of the verb, shall make no law, then needs to express what those laws would be in terms of their effects, which produces these verbal structures, these forms of the adjectival use of the subsequent verbs to describe what sorts of legislation must not occur. Legislation respecting an establishment of religion, legislation prohibiting the free exercise of religion, or legislation abridging freedom of speech or of the press, and the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition government for a redress of grievances. In other words, laws respecting one thing, prohibiting another thing, or abridging four more things. Or maybe that's three. Or perhaps it's really all one thing being abridged, the way one thing is being prohibited and one thing being not respected. In short, what we need to understand is that these parts of the sentence in parallel describe forms of legislative power that Congress may not exercise. Why then may not it exercise power respecting an establishment of religion? We are, of course, inclined in 20th century and in 21st century cases, wherever we think we stand on the Establishment Clause, we are inclined always to assume that it's a clause prohibiting establishment, but it is not. It is a law prohibiting Congress from exercising legislative authority respecting an establishment of religion. And of course, from the historical point of view, this is quite straightforward. It means Congress may not interfere with the establishment of religion in places where, like Massachusetts and Virginia, there is a state-established religion. Nor may it establish religions in places such as New York, where the attempt to establish a religion would immediately cause civil disruption. The point here isn't that Congress may not establish religion, it is that Congress may not act one way or another with respect to establishing religion. And while it is indeed possible to take the view that ultimately this doesn't mean what it says any more than Congress shall make no law means what it says in some literalist sense, it's important to grasp the clarity with which the first Congress wields its grammar and chooses its forms. The way it uses the participles that it places. Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. It may not act one way or another with respect to the establishments in the states, but it may not invoke intolerant provisions with respect to religious practice. We have gone through a period of rapid change with respect to the meaning of the free exercise clause over the course of the past generation, which is perceived as an extraordinarily important change in the balance between the Establishment Clause and the free exercise clause, and so it well may be. If one is playing that game, then it has rules, and the law review articles that result are valid. But from the point of view of understanding the sentence itself, that is, comprehending what it is that Congress is not allowed to do, cases about village common wishing wells and the prayers before high school football games are peculiarly ill-placed to explain to us the nature of what it is that Congress, or even for that matter a state legislature, may not do. If tolerance may not be interfered with and establishment, if tolerance may not be reduced and establishment may not be interfered with, then of course we come to the most important of the participles in the First Amendment, that of abridging. We shall have a good deal more to think about with respect to a Congress not abridging than with respect to their non-legislation respecting or their prohibition. It is the abridgments that Congress may not make that will be our primary concern over the next weeks, and so we'd best to think about that abridging carefully before we start. To abridge, well, Ambrose Bierce says in the Devil's Dictionary, transitive verb, to shorten. And burlesques the Declaration of Independence by saying that when in the course of human events the people feel it necessary to abridge their king, and puts the quotation in the hands of Oliver Cromwell. It is indeed true that from a literary sense to abridge is to shorten, and Bierce is surely correct that whether we are anatomically or textually shortening, we are abridging when we lop off. Abridgment is a verb with a meaning in the law. The abridgment is, after all, the short version of information culled from the yearbooks, what ultimately the legal publishers will call the digest rather than the abridgment. Digestion is a process more unfavorable to the preservation of integrity than abridgment, and the use by the First Congress of abridgment surely didn't come at the moment when somebody suggested as a synonym the possibility that the Congress shall make no law digesting the freedom of speech. Abridgment then in that sense means confinement as well as shortening. Limitation in the sense of reduction. Congress shall not abridge rights by hobbling, reducing, confining, limiting, or interfering with them. And it is that range of activity that is reductive. The legislative effort to erode, to wear away, to slice, as later generations of judges more culinarily various, I suppose we shall say, to slice the sausage or the salami. The forms of legislative interaction with these rights, freedom of speech or of the press, the assembly peaceably to petition government for redress of grievances, these are not to be abridged. And once one deals with the word itself, one recognizes the breadth of the implication. It's not like respecting, the breadth of which, as a matter of implication, is nothing to do with this subject, but it is far broader than prohibiting, which verges on the merely formalistic. A bridge is the word of a legal realist meaning to say, keep off anything that looks like the grass. So, if the First Amendment's purpose, then, is to prevent the exercise of legislative power by the federal imperial authority now being created above the states, and if the goal is by insulating the people and their state governments from lawmaking by the imperial power, having in mind the series of episodes of lawmaking in the English and Northern European past to which they most definitely wish to gesture, because those are the things that create the revolutions, because those are the things which deteriorate the possibility of government. If James II had not so clearly made law respecting the establishment of religion and prohibiting free exercise in the High Commission, if he had not, in the Seven Bishops case, so deeply injured the Englishman's right of petitioning government, then there would not have been a revolution in 1688, and while that revolution may be glorious, the principle of the First Amendment is to avoid the future glorious revolutions of America by prohibiting imperial power from, and then, of course, They do read the history of the Dutch Revolt. They know it well. They may not yet have Motley's multi-volume histories to read, but they know the world of the Dutch Revolt as they know their own, because indeed it is their own. They remember what was done by the Spanish army in Harlem. And they may not recall with as much fondness as the inhabitants of Leiden, the resistance of Leiden, but they know it well. They know that to prohibit people from worshiping God in their own way at the end of the day will cause war. And that is not the war for which they are building a better domestic tranquility and a more perfect union. There are then areas of cultural self-expression by the people in the states to which it is understood that an imperial government must not ever be tempted to exercise control or to express hostility. This is statesmanship at work, in that sense. But it is statesmanship informed by the long and complex histories of the colonial societies of British North America, who on each of these matters have their own hard-won sense of the difficulty of preserving political coherence in the presence of over-regulation by government of the religious or expressive lives of the people. And they recognize that the voice of the people being heard by peaceable assembly and petition is what makes it feasible for those who rule the many as the few to succeed in the task. When you shoot people at demonstrations, whether in Boston or in Belarus, whether in Manhattan or in Minsk, you bring on what the Tsar Vladimir now thinks of as the color revolutions, red, white, and blue, as well as rose or orange. In that sense, then, the First Amendment serves as a primary demonstration of the receipt of the anti-federalist message, not only with respect to the formal importance of a Bill of Rights, but with respect to the importance of the designation of those elements of legal development in the states that are not part of the federalist experiment and will never be, unless the nation is forced to the arbitrament of force. That 18th century view, which animates the sentence that is the First Amendment, the federal imperial government must refrain from certain forms of lawmaking, or else the union and the stability of the domestic societies that comprise it cannot stand, is far from the mind of any Supreme Court which has ever actively investigated the meaning of the Fourth Amendment to contemporary, of the First Amendment to contemporary society. That's as true in 1919 as it is true in 2019. And one of the peculiarities of the First Amendment's history is that the process of its legal invocation significantly begins only upon the moment of the abandonment of the fundamental premise in which the First Congress is indulging as it writes. So that we have the meaning of the First Amendment, and the meaning of the First Amendment as the Supreme Court begins inflating it in the era of the First World War, and we have a gap in between. For today, I simply want to point out that that gap, like so many other parts of the constitutional history of the United States, that gap is made of slavery. The primary problem of the maintenance of a system of slavery is that it can stand only upon violence, and it can resist everything except knowledge. Even now, of course, the system of slavery continues to depend in the United States upon the absence of knowledge, not in order for it to exist, for it does not exist. That was the outcome of the arbitrament of force. But for its consequences to be, well, ignored or underemphasized. It is remarkable, if one teaches undergraduates or even law students in the United States, it is remarkable how many young people, well educated from the point of view of the state as they may be, have really very little understanding of slavery as an operational process. Which is part of why the current conversation in the United States is both heated and, well, not very capable of progress, not to say progressivism. But it's more important, of course, that a system of slavery actually in being must defend itself towards its captives with force, and towards bystanders with ignorance and the cultivation of indifference. From the point of view of those who ran the House Divided, the managers of the society that the United States was between the moment of its creation and the enactment of the and the Declaration of the Emancipation Proclamation and the enactment of the 13th Amendment, for those who ran the Union half slave and half free, there are two problems to be dealt with on an urgent basis all the time, one of which is those slaves who have escaped from the use of force, the fugitives, of whom it is the view of the 1787 Constitution that they should, upon appropriate request, be rendered up. And the idea of freedom, which from the point of view of the managers of a union half slave and half free has to live on one side of the line lest it contaminate the other. A system maintained by force fears force more than it fears anything else. That is, after all, why the slave revolt is the nightmare of the managers of the half slave portion, the whole slave portion of half the union. And the greatest of all ideas capable of stimulating a resort to force by the slaves themselves is the idea of freedom. Thus it is necessary, not optional, not good to have, but necessary from the point of view of the management of a union half slave and half free, that the idea of freedom, of the abolition of slavery, of the right of every person to exist and make the living by the sweat of their own brow and own the produce of their labor, that idea must not be allowed to circulate. And thus, of course, it is that in the United States before the Civil War, it is not allowed to mail abolitionist literature. In the end, it will be necessary to prohibit enslaved persons from learning how to read. In the end, the imposition of ignorance cannot be achieved merely by the control of what would be designated misinformation. But the prevention of the circulation of misinformation and what the form of circulation of ideas must be, well, it's the mails, government's delivery of mail that must be controlled. And thus, an important part of the work of Congress and the Supreme Court in antebellum America is to avoid the question. As the gag rule in the House of Representatives prohibits the discussion of the legal condition of slavery after the abolition of the trade in 1808, the First Amendment cannot actively exist in a society in which the government of the United States must censor all the mail to prohibit the mailing of abolitionist literature. We have more to say in understanding the sudden efflorescence of the First Amendment in the 20th century and its rapid incorporation in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, and the nature of the process by which this sentence reaches us, clausified and decorated as it may have been by what memorialization turned it into the most important part of the Bill of Rights. But first we have to understand that the relation between the First Amendment and freedom is the one that hobbled it and kept its words unread and unthought for in the bulk of the time between the First Congress and the First World War. Talk to you soon.